This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. 100 years ago, the human population on this planet was less than 2 billion. Now it's over 7 billion. And some projections suggest we'll be at 8 billion in just 20 years. It's not controversial to point out that humans have a massive impact on the Earth's resources and landscape, and that the more people we have, the more of a challenge it is to allocate those resources. What gets trickier is when we start to talk about what should be done about the number of people on the planet. Should governments be in the business of limiting reproduction, or even putting incentives in place to limit reproduction? You could certainly argue that our tax structure is weighted in favor of people having children. Or is education the answer? One of our guests today says population is the elephant in the room whenever global climate change, sustainability, and environmental stewardship is discussed. Tom Butler is the editorial director at the Foundation for Deep Ecology, and he's the editor of a new book called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. Tom, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And we're also joined today by Missy Thurston. She's with the Center for the Population Media Center based in Vermont, and she's contributed to this book as well. The center has. And they work in developing nations and elsewhere to try to educate people about overpopulation. Missy, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
So let's talk about this a little bit. Let's talk about overpopulation and why you think it's a problem. And Tom, I'd love for you to explain why you think, first of all, it's the elephant in the room.
Well, if we were to listen to public radio for a few days or a few hours even, we would hear all kinds of interesting coverage of climate change, perhaps coverage about social inequity, looming poverty, grave issues of malnutrition in parts of the developing world. We would almost certainly hear coverage of elements of our toxic energy economy and the global extinction crisis and crashing wildlife populations. I dare say, if we listen to public radio, and I'm an avid listener myself, for a week we would hear very few times when the sheer number of people on the planet and the way we have designed our economic activity, how it amplifies or drives all of those questions. So essentially, we're talking about symptoms and not root causes. To address why it's the elephant in the room would take perhaps all day, and a lot of people have more scholarly folks than I have addressed this question. But to give a brief and superficial answer, I'd say this is one of the few questions in American public life where there is such resistance. It has become a taboo because the pressures not to talk about it come from both the political right and the left, which is an interesting thing. If you are talking about the human population trajectory, inevitably, this brings in questions of sexuality, contraception, abortion rights, religious values, immigration. All of those are hot-button issues. It's a political minefield. The easiest thing is not to go there. And on the far left of the spectrum, at least on the fringes, there is a very quick sometimes inclination to throw out words like racism or eugenics or colonialism at people who want to discuss family planning, particularly if it's family planning programs that originate in the overdeveloped world and being targeted or assisting people in the underdeveloped world in high fertility countries.
All right, we're going to get into some of that. Missy, I'd love for you to jump in here, though, and explain how you even define overpopulation, because certainly that idea of what is the carrying capacity, what's a population, sustainable population versus overpopulation is not a definition that everybody agrees on. So how do you define overpopulation?
Well, the way we define it is if the natural environment cannot support the number of people that are living there in a renewable resource type environment. So basically, the title of the book that Tom edited is Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And overshoot is a term that many people are not familiar with. And basically, what happens in overshoot is when you've exhausted the renewable resources, that the resources that can be regenerated within that same period of time. So you're now tapping into archival resources or resources that take, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of years to create. So each year, actually, there is an overshoot day. And so it changes each year because every year we use up what can be regenerated within that year on a different day. and it's always earlier in the year. So last year, overshoot occurred in August, and this year they're anticipating that it'll be July or August again. So basically, sustainable population means that we are being able to regenerate what we're using within that same time period.
But that's not a number. So if we're talking about a number, yep. How do you get to that? Because certainly that, how much we use our resources differs from one country to another, yeah. From one person to another. So is it about a number of people or is it about the amount of resources that individuals are using?
It's both. So, you know, certainly, and that's one of the things that I think makes a lot of people very uncomfortable. So in the United States, for instance, there's approximately a little bit less than 5% of the world's population, but we're consuming, by some estimates, 25% of the world's resources. So this is where the title of the book again comes into play, overdevelopment and overpopulation. These are both parts of the equation. And so coming up with an exact number is a very difficult thing, and it's going to change depending upon how we are using our resources. But both parts of the equation are essential elements to come up to that final, you know, how are we fitting in with the natural environment.
We're talking today about population and overpopulation. I know a lot of listeners have thoughts on this and want to chime in. Certainly that term population control strikes a nerve with a lot of people. But our guests today say it's not about overt control. It's about education. It's about thinking about global sustainability. Nevertheless, they say humans need to slow their growth on this planet if we want it to survive. You can give us your take. Do you see overpopulation as a fundamental root cause of many of the world's environmental issues? Do we need a new model for the economy that doesn't rely on growth? Call with your thoughts. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We've already been getting a lot of emails and posts coming in before the show. George says, it feels to me like we're reaching a tipping point. The resources to support so many humans are dwindling fast, and no one economic system seems capable of functioning at this scale. We don't appear to have the clarity or will to do anything about it. George says, I believe the planet will eventually take care of itself, shake us off like so many fleas, and get on with the process of regeneration. And Viv K says, people reject the overpopulation message despite the overwhelming facts and damage to our planet. It's a sacred cow because people think they're wonderful and beyond planetary limits. Until the economy comes to the brick wall of resource and debt limits, then people might wake up that our actions and growth are not sustainable. So we've been talking a little bit about that concept of overshoot that, Missy, you introduced, and certainly that's one way we can see how population growth is having an impact on resources and on the natural landscape. Tom, go a little deeper. What else do you see as a problem in terms of how human population and overpopulation is shaping the planet?
Well, our goal with the book was to present that visually. The book is this large format series of images.
I have to say about the book, given that you're talking about overpopulation and the enormity of human development and our overconsumption, this is a huge book. It must weigh 20 pounds.
Well, I think that's hyperbole. It's a large book. It doesn't weigh 20 pounds. But it is a big book because it's a big topic. It's a big subject. If you wanted to show, let's give an example. If you had a beautiful little blue-green planet spinning out there in the blackness of space, and life had occurred there for several billion years, and then in essentially a geological eye blink, you put 7.3 billion people on it, organizing their economic activities in a certain way, and in the current context, that's a techno-industrial growth culture, which is designed to grow perpetually. How would that transform the Earth? What would it look like? And that was specifically our goal with the book and the related website and campaign, to show in emotionally evocative imagery what is the effect of that on nature, on non-human nature, and on people. What does it look like for someone to be trying to catch a train in Bangladesh or get through their commute in the middle of the day in Beijing and have to walk through a fog of haze so dark you almost need a headlamp to see where you're going?
And since this isn't a visual medium, maybe you can describe just one of those photos to give people a sense of what you're trying to show with this.
Well, the book is organized in a series of brief photo essays in many different topics: energy economy, feeding, how we have transformed so much of the earth to feed humanity, and that burgeoning, the continuing trajectory of humans. I will say, just, I know, yes, it's a radio is not really a visual medium, and this is why we have the entire book is online, available for viewing at populationspeakout.org. And people can go there and look at the images and see which ones they find emotionally evocative. I'll say for me, there are two images in the book that really just make me shudder. And one of them is of a thresher shark caught in a net off the coast of Mexico, clearly in a fisherman's net, probably as bycatch. And it's a stunning image underwater of a shark almost in a crucifixion, a crucified form. And to me, that represents the ideology of dominion and control and a loss of beauty and potential for that creature. I see the same ideas represented in a photo we included of two young girls in Yemen, who were both 8 years old when the photo was taken. And you see them there standing with much older men who you assume are their fathers. But when you read the caption, you realize that these two 8-year-old girls have been sold or given over as child brides. Now, there's a demographic ramification to child marriage and to age of first birth. There are societal issues and demographic consequences of that. But it is absolutely wrenching to think of the life of those children, that loss of beauty and potential and autonomy that represented in that photo of child marriage. So I see the same ideas represented. The way that humans are using the earth, our numbers and our behavior, have these dire consequences for both people and nature, and it's time to talk about this. That's the whole point of the book and the campaign.
Let's talk about economics and how that fits in. In the book, certainly, you're talking about overdevelopment in addition to overpopulation. Economically, there are problems with reducing the population. Some countries that we already see that are fairly well populated are trying to encourage more population growth because their economies rely on it. And in this country, when you see some of the ways we've set up our economy, having a lower population growth isn't going to be beneficial for the economy as it is set up now. You can just think about Social Security payments. You can think about job growth. You can think about questions we're already having as the boomers get old. So, Missy Thurston, how do you think we can change this idea of population and how many people are sustainable while also looking at the economic picture as it's set up to encourage growth?
Well, I think it's a really complex question because there's a lot of things that go into that. But I think that, you know, one of the biggest flaws of our discussion when it comes to economics is that growth is growth is growth. And it's always presented as a positive, something that you're striving for. And really, there's not an analysis. There's a few different things. There's not an analysis of, you know, the quality of the community, which has direct implications on the economics of the community. So, you know, GDP per capita is not always looked at. It's just GDP. And the really, if you're going to take a look at, you know, the well-being of countries, like basically every country that has been reclassified from developing to developed countries since World War II first has undergone a population, they've started to introduce fertility exercises, you know, introduced family planning and education to control their population growth in order to reach economic goals. Because when you have really large families that can't be supported by that family, then you introduce a lot of governmental support or other challenges. So there's growth. Growth does not equal positive all the time, which is really important. Then the other really important aspect of economics is that it has to be taken in regard to the natural resources, because when we run out of something and something collapses, there's going to be horrific consequences. So the idea that economics is completely independent of what's happening around us in the natural world is a very short-sighted approach that's going to eventually have, you know, not only economic consequences that are disastrous, but also, you know, human health, human rights, introduce other problems as well.
But isn't it those countries that have lower population growth, that have instituted more family planning, more education around that, that are often also the drivers of carbon footprint? If you look at the list of the carbon footprint of nations per capita, as you're suggesting, mm-hmm. Missy, it's not the countries with the largest population growth that are by and large the drivers of carbon and putting carbon into the atmosphere. It's developed countries that have a much lower rate of population growth. Luxembourg, I think, is the country with the highest rate or the highest carbon footprint per capita. Now, that's not a country that's seeing significant population growth. It doesn't have the size to do that. Mm-hmm. France, Spain, Austria, these industrialized nations that are worried about having a lack of population growth are often the ones that are driving the carbon footprint and putting carbon into the atmosphere. So, Tom, again, is it about people, numbers of people, or is it about industrialization and consumption?
Again, it's both. Both of these factors. There, anyone who is a rational person looking at the current state of global climate change and the resulting climate chaos that is likely to ensue in coming decades and centuries, any rational person is going to say, well, who broke the climate? It was largely the overdeveloped countries, countries that live like us and that have had the benefit of this fossil fuel windfall, this bonanza of 200 years of development based on the perceived unlimited cheap energy that fossil energy presented to drive an economic growth. The countries that are largely suffering the most from the problems of malnutrition and poverty are typically high fertility countries with a very much lower carbon footprint per capita, but also with real demonstrable impacts on the community of life. You know, there are many countries, high fertility countries in Africa, where there is a wildlife poaching and extinction crisis. Now, the factors behind that are complex, but every human being on Earth, whether they're in a poor and underdeveloped country or in the affluent world, has a footprint. It may be larger, it may be smaller, but we all affect the global community of life and the biotic community. This question that you were trying to drive to is that we have an economic model that's now based on perpetual growth. And doesn't this question have to eventually morph into a transformation of our economic system? The short answer to that, of course, is yes. Now, it's not an explicit component of the book or the campaign. But again, any rational person understands, I would think, that the Earth is a finite place. It's bounded. It has certain limitations. And yet we have a currently fashionable economic model based on perpetual growth and infinite growth. And as the late economist Kenneth Boulding once said, the only people who believe in perpetual growth on a finite planet are either madmen or economists.
We're going to talk about more of this, including, okay, so now what? So what are the solutions? What are we driving towards? What are our guests today thinking would be ways to look at this issue and find ways to reduce population growth? How do we do that? How do you encourage or educate people to have fewer children? How could economies that require a growing supply of new workers survive in a new model? What does the new economic picture look like? Listeners, you can tell us what it looks like for you. Do you think about this? Did population growth factor into your considerations about how many children you wanted to have? Do you see this issue as part and parcel of the environmental movement? Our number, if you'd like to chime in, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Join Andrew, who says, prosperous people tend to have fewer children, yet we progressives who care about people and the environment seem to glorify picturesque poverty for other people. We should be championing global trade, which has reduced the global poverty rate to the lowest in history and increased the global middle class to the largest in history. Interesting perspective there on the economic picture and population growth. Again, add yours to the mix. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're exploring why some environmentalists say the elephant in the room in discussions about sustainability is the explosion of human population over the last 100 years. They say more needs to be done to reduce population growth in conjunction with any other carbon reduction efforts. Missy Thurston is the director of marketing and communication at the Vermont-based Population Media Center. Tom Butler is the editorial director at the Foundation for Deep Ecology and editor of a new book called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. And we're hearing thoughts from some of you as well. If you'd like to weigh in or ask a question, you can post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. Art says, you ask if there's any way to slow down worldwide population growth. It's already happening. World population growth will fall by more than 90% during this century. People, and especially women, are already making decisions to reduce the number of births they have over their lifetime. That's due to better knowledge and education. Mark says, to procreate or not is a conscious decision that we, in an educated society, have the luxury of making. In some cultures, having lots of children is still seen as a wonderful thing. Until humans everywhere understand the fundamental concept of sustainability, we're on a dubious and troubled road. Charlie says, the population problem won't be solved by harassing people who want kids or passing weird laws to that effect. It would be solved immediately if women had full control of their bodies and the education and cultural support to do so, and if people weren't pressured to have more kids than they want, or any, if they want none. In places where this is happening, population is already dropping. And to put a fine point on that, Joe says, the low-hanging fruit is that every woman in the world should have free contraceptives available. Here's a little bit of a trailer for East Los High. It's produced by the Population Media Center based here in Vermont, and it's part of their effort to tackle some of the issues that drive population growth through education with locally produced soap operas.
This year's winner king and winner queen are Jacob Aguilar and Vanessa de la Cruz.
You should totally go for him. Are you crazy? He's dating Vanessa.
Yes, I'm
going to
show you.
In the parking lot?
He's
so nasty.
So are you.
All right, that's a little clip from East Los High. Again, that's produced by the Population Media Center. Missy, tell us a little bit about what these productions are like. This is coming out on Hulu in June, and it's going to be a series available for people to watch. Very high production value, lots of drama, lots of young people. The trailer has lots of beautiful young people making out. So what's the idea here?
Sure. So, the Population Media Center our primary focus is creating serial dramas or soap operas, and they are a form of entertainment education with an emphasis on the entertainment. That's why it comes first, because if people don't watch it, it doesn't make a difference. So that particular program, East Los High, it is a Hulu. We partnered with Hulu, so it's a Hulu original series. It'll actually be going into its third season this summer, so it launched 2 years ago. We were actually nominated for 3 Daytime Emmys this year, which was really exciting. So basically, each one of our serial dramas is based on a ton of formative research, where we're trying to figure out what issues really need to be addressed in this area. So when the research for East Los High was done, we were facing above a 50%. Percentage of Latina girls who were pregnant at least once before the age of 20 in the United States. And so that had multiple ramifications. You were seeing it across high school completion rates and other aspects of their lives. And so we realized that although most of our work happens overseas, there was some education we should be doing in our own backyard. So that particular program is really targeting, it targets a number of different things, but it targets information about sexual education information, family planning. It also addresses things like nutrition, because there was a lot of really wonderful, rich information we got when we were doing the research about different cultural things that could be woven into the program that demonstrate what an amazing community this is, and just bring that out. So it's based in East LA, and we've been pleased, just like with most of our programs, in the very first month of broadcast, our website for East Los High resulted in more than 27,000 unique visitors to Planned Parenthood widgets that were not visitors previously, to figure out how to be tested for various STDs, particularly HIV and AIDS, because that was part of one of the storylines, and information about reproductive services and family planning.
And is that the idea here, that you're trying to educate people, and in this case, and in a lot of what you do, through entertainment, rather than saying you need to have fewer children, sort of an overt hit you over the head with it?
Yeah, kind of, and it's a the methodology is chosen for a number of different reasons, one of which is that some of these issues are very difficult to talk about. And so if you can provide stories and characters that are displaying different actions, then it may give people who otherwise would be uncomfortable maybe talking with their partner or other people to talk about it in the third person, you know, related to Vanessa versus yourself. Another really important aspect of it is, you know, each culture and each community is completely different. And so by creating storylines, you can really tailor the content to what's appropriate for that particular area. We hire all local writers, staffs, producers. And the other value is that we have these dramas take place over the course of a very long time. So when you're introducing something like Tom was saying about child marriage, for instance, there are countries where 50 to 75% of the girls are married by the time they're 12. And this is a cultural norm, and this is not a light topic. And so you have to really introduce it gradually over the course of time through these characters exhibiting different behaviors for people to even be willing to have the conversation. You know, child marriage is obviously an incredibly emotional and, you know, it's very touchy, but so is pretty much everything that we work on. So this approach really allows us to show different options and let people then have discussion and actually decide what's right for them.
Tom Butler, what do you think? Is this approach enough, this sort of, I don't mean it in a negative way, soft approach, but this idea of, you know, we're going to come to you where you are, and we're using drama and entertainment and media to try to broach these messages for you and for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Is that the right approach, the only approach?
It's not the only approach, but it's absolutely a crucial one. And part of the reason we wanted to work with Population Media Center on this effort and this campaign is we are huge fans of the work they are doing in more than 50 countries around the world now to model different social norms, new cultural values. We think they're extremely effective, perhaps the leading and most innovative population NGO, certainly in the U.S. and maybe on Earth. And the reason why it's so crucial to be engaged in this way is that there are two issues, one of which you read from an emailer. He referred to this lack of contraception. We know that there are more than 200 million women on Earth who are not using contraception and yet who say they do not wish to become pregnant. Well, part of that is a supply chain issue, certainly delivering family planning tools and services to underserved rural areas. But also the second half, and in some ways the more difficult challenge, is changing those cultural norms about family size. And this is where Population Media Center is doing such a spectacular job.
We've got a lot of comments from people weighing in here, too. We have one from Desta who says, I'm from Ethiopia, a poor but overpopulated country, and I now live in Burlington. I believe religion and lack of education have contributed to overpopulation. The world we live in today is with few wealthy and billions of poor. Why would any rational human being bring children into this cruel world for suffering? Robert says any consideration of overpopulation and attempts at a solution will inevitably run headlong into the concrete wall of religious tradition. In this sense, tradition is one of the greatest stumbling blocks to human progress. Tom, you want to weigh in on that?
Sure. Again, this is the question we're discussing, changing social norms. Social norms change over time. If one had plopped down in North America 100 years ago, family size was very different, in part driven by social norms and religious values. It's very different today. These things evolve over time, and they can evolve quickly. We know, and several of your listeners alluded to this, that the means to progress in changing this demographic trajectory are very simple. If you empower women, you educate girls, and you make family planning tools and information universally available, birth rates come down. They come down quickly, and that happens across cultures. Up until just quite recently, when unfortunately these programs are starting to be unraveled, the great success story in the Islamic world was Iran, which had a tremendously effective family planning program that was consistent with that country's religious and cultural traditions. So I grant the caller, she is right, that religious attitudes certainly play a role and are a stumbling block, but these things can change, and they absolutely need to change because of the urgency of the situation. Human population growth, and again, some of your listeners alluded to this, that rates of growth have gone down. This is true. But we are still adding new numbers of people to the global population.
It's still positive growth.
So rapidly. It's in fact, almost an abstraction when you talk about X number of billions will be added in X number of years. And this is why I always use the Fenway Park analogy. If many of us Vermonters have been to Fenway Park, and we know it's not quite 40,000 people, but if you sit there in the stands and David Ortiz makes a great play, the crowd erupts and you feel like you're with a lot of people when you're with 40,000 people. Well, don't fill up Fenway Park just one time or twice, but five times and then half again. 5.5 Fenway Parks worth of human beings, new people, come to the breakfast table on Earth every 24 hours, and we would want them to be able to eat breakfast and lunch and dinner and have a reasonable quality of life, even while allowing enough of wild nature to persist on Earth that the bears and the wolves and the whales can feed their families too and also fulfill their aspirations.
We got a note from Maria in Walcott who says, whatever rights humans have to populate have to be balanced with those same rights of other species. Humans don't like to admit it, but we're a species, and nature will impose her limits on us one way or the other. Is it fair that humans consume an estimated 40% of the planet's net primary productivity, the chemical energy plants produce minus what they need for respiration? Almost half for just one species? Yes, there are social and other pressures, but take it from a woman who was always told by others that she'd want children eventually. I never had kids and never had 1 minute of regret. Heidi says, my husband and I decided not to have children because of the overpopulation problem. I stress this may have seemed like a sacrifice, but in reality, it was an incredible choice to make, and we are thriving and enjoying life to the fullest. The idea of child-free should be marketed positively and not as a negative. I can't tell you how many friends of ours have kids because they don't want to miss out on this life experience, but then they miss out on an incredible life of many other enriching things. And let's go to David, who's calling in from Rochester. Hi, David. Go right ahead.
Yes, Heidi just called, and she said she was remaining childless out of concern. And there's this famous cartoon where a bunch of concerned parents are sitting around, and one of them says that she wanted to have another child, but that it meant that she had to go to the third world and convince 40 people not to have a child because she knew that her footprint was 40 times their footprint. And so we know it's everything. It has to do a lot with footprint, this problem of overpopulation. And I was wondering, regardless of footprint, your commentators must have a number in their mind as to what they think are the right number of people on the planet. I wondered what that number was for each of them.
David, thanks. Missy?
David, I don't have a specific number. The number that we typically are shooting for when we're discussing population at Population Media Center is aiming for what seems possible, basically, always in a human rights framework, so that we can be empowering people to make their own decisions. And it's through education and family planning services and information and women's rights that we are able to, address the issue. The UN varies widely, so they have population projections. And if you take a look at their projections for the year 2100, those projections range from 6 billion people on the planet, which is about 1.3 billion fewer than there are today, to 16.6 billion people on the planet, which is a more than doubling of the number of people today. So we definitely focus on the low projection.
And without a number, though, how do you know what we're aiming for, Tom?
Well, the number needs to be less. We know that the climate is broken, that poverty is grave. We know that so many people around the world are suffering, particularly in high-fertility countries. So the number needs to be less. There are scholars, there are experts who've done rigorous analyses of these, and it depends upon your parameters, what variability of affluence, what sort of technology, and what you assume in terms of set-asides for non-human nature to get to a number. Those numbers that I've seen range from a few hundred million to perhaps 1 to 2 billion people on Earth. Now, just 200 years ago, at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, the global population was 1 billion. So we know that from all of our history as a species to the year 1800, population growth was incredibly, incredibly slow, and that we were able to live in a 100% renewable energy economy in the year 1800 with 1 billion people. That's a number possibly to look at.
That's Tom Butler. He's the editorial director at the Foundation for Deep Ecology and editor of a new book called Overdevelopment, Overpopulation, Overshoot. Missy Thurston is director of marketing and communication at the Vermont-based Population Media Center. Thanks very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you want to look at this from a Vermont perspective, we'll link to an earlier show we did on a report that came out trying to estimate what's a sustainable population for Vermont. We'll put that link up at vpr.net. After the break, we'll talk with Vermonters who have a strong connection with Nepal. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The news from Nepal last weekend was devastating. And as we learn more about the destruction of the massive earthquake there, we're also reminded that many people in Vermont have personal and professional connections to Nepal, and they're trying to figure out ways to help. In the Burlington area, there's a substantial Bhutanese population. Many spent years in refugee camps in Nepal. Among them is 19-year-old Tek Lyutel, who's a student at Burlington High School. Yesterday, he attended a meeting of students who are organizing fundraisers for earthquake relief.
I grew up in the refugee camp where there is like no lots of resources and opportunity. One day it was our house also burned by the fire, and then I feel really bad, and then it was really painful for me. So same thing I can imagine for them right now. We can help them by donating some money. Like, you don't have to donate lots of money, but even $1 or $2, everybody needs to be like help for them, because we the people, we are the human beings, so we got to like solve each other's problems.
Jitan Katka is a youth outreach organizer at Spectrum Youth and Family Services. He's been helping the Nepali and Bhutanese community here bring their efforts together to support earthquake victims.
I don't have, you know, my close family living in the Kathmandu area, but I do have a lot of friends. They go to school there and also work. I've been messaging to most of my friends and to see, you know, if they have been they're okay. You know, we have a bigger Nepali community in Vermont, and especially in Burlington, Winooski area, and you know, been really directly affected by this. And there are people out in the community really wanted to help and organize to do something. You know, at this moment we can't just fly and go to Nepal and do anything. You know, like people from everywhere, like they're trying to do something. And you know, we created a Facebook page yesterday, and there's more than 600 people in there, like trying to, you know, come out to help, and, you know, getting a lot of calls from people. How can I help? What can I do, you know?
There are also Vermont organizations that have leveraged deep professional expertise to do ongoing work in Nepal. When ophthalmologist Jeffrey Tabin joined the UVM College of Medicine faculty 20 years ago, he started a nonprofit called the Himalayan Cataract Project. It has dramatically lowered the rate of blindness among the Nepalese and improved the infrastructure of eye care generally. Since the earthquake, Dr. Tabin says that network of health centers, eye doctors, and nurses is being put to use to aid victims.
Our main hospital in Kathmandu, the Togani Institute of Ophthalmology, is right now overwhelmed dealing with head and eye trauma. The earthquake has just been devastating. It's much more than, you know, what you hear in the news. The amount of destruction and the amount of infrastructure that's been knocked out. You know, Nepal is the 157th poorest country in the world. And knocking out electricity, knocking out the water supply, knocking out sanitation and sewage systems, it's going to be a real horrendous problem. And so, you know, in a situation like this now, just 3 days out, we've been really rallying, trying to bring the kind of basic assistance that's necessary. So trying to bring clean water and shelter has been a big priority. And our doctors have been really working around the clock, helping deal with the trauma. And most of the injuries are traumatic. There are a lot of head injuries, a lot of eye injuries. But in the next several weeks, we're going to also be starting to expand outward there's very poor communication in Nepal and many, many small little villages, small little hill villages that were closer to the epicenter of the quake. And all you really hear on the news in America are reports of what's the number of people they found dead in Kathmandu and the people who are on Mount Everest and the avalanche at base camp. But there are so many small villages of a few hundred to a few thousand people in between that are absolutely devastated, and where there's still a very significant number of people with bad traumatic injuries that have yet to be reached by help. And so we're working, being used to carrying out, you know, mobile outreach cataract programs. We really have the skills and experience to bring that immediate assistance to the people in the remote area.
Yeah, so they're trying to bring assistance to the people in the remote area, as Tabin says. He also says the Nepali doctors and nurses on the staff of the Himalayan Cataract Project at the hospital in Kathmandu are trying to both treat patients and take care of their own families, who are also earthquake victims. Meanwhile, the Vermont staff is trying to raise money from the project's donor base. On the first day of fundraising, they raised more than $50,000. 18-year-old Maddie Hyams of Shalott was getting her first introduction to Nepal when the earthquake struck. She's spending a gap year in a remote village, living with a family on an organic farm. Her mother, Kristen DeStichter, described what she knows of Maddie's experience since the earthquake.
They got hit quite hard. She was inside the house when the earthquake hit and was able to somehow ran outside with the rest of the family. The house collapsed, and even now they're not able to get back into most of the house. They've been able to crawl back in to get some of the food out of the kitchen, but they did lose their house. Fortunately, they do live on a farm, so they have access to food, and they're using water from a rain barrel, which was traditionally what they were doing anyway, and they boil the water. So from a day-to-day perspective, they really haven't been hit too hard with respect to access to food and water. The biggest challenge for them is not knowing what's out there. So they have no idea about road access. Would they be able to get to the town if they needed to? And they haven't seen anybody come to them. So certainly no aid workers have found them at this point. She's going to stay put because she's in a safe place with food and water and shelter, and we're waiting to hear from the State Department about what the road access is like, and we'll see what happens.
We heard a few minutes ago about students trying to raise funds for relief efforts. Many Vermonters are thinking about how to help, and on the question of how to give aid to people in Nepal, we turn to the Vermont Community Foundation. Christopher Kaufman Ilstrup is a senior philanthropic advisor there.
The Community Foundation always says that you need to take two approaches to disaster response. You need to first, of course, be thinking about the immediate response to the disaster, that there are people who are going to be in need of housing, food, and shelter right away. And then the second approach is really about medium and long-term recovery. And we saw that, of course, in Irene. You know, there was an initial emergency response to get food and water to people who needed it. And then there was a much longer, in fact, still ongoing need to support people in their recovery process. And we would expect that to be the case in Nepal as well. Typically, monetary help is what's needed, especially in an international situation where money is easy to get to places and stuff is not so easy. We encourage people to, as they're researching organizations to give to look for international organizations that have already been on the ground working in Nepal on other development projects, rather than organizations that are going into Nepal for the first time. So, for example, you might be giving to Oxfam or Save the Children, which has a long-time presence in Nepal, rather than an organization who is just starting out and doesn't know much about the situation on the ground.
What about an international aid organization like the Red Cross?
Sure. Yeah, well, the International Red Cross has chapters all over the world, including a chapter in Nepal, and we know from our research that the American Red Cross is already working in coordination with the Nepal Red Cross. So that's a perfectly acceptable option. for short-term immediate relief. And you can also give to some of these other organizations as well. There's a lot of resources out there. The one that we recommend is disasterphilanthropy.org, and they have information about probably 20 different international NGOs that you can give to right now for immediate relief. They also have a fund set up for the midterm and long-term recovery work as well that you can give to directly. But I think, you know, one of the things that I find really important in doing this work is that I look for groups that are collaborative in nature, not groups that are sort of trying to make a name for themselves and only want to promote their own work, so that you know that people are really filling in all the gaps.
The Vermont Community Foundation has put together a resource page of organizations working on emergency response and longer-term recovery in Nepal. You can find a link to that and other groups we've mentioned at vpr.net. If you've missed something on Vermont Edition or want to share what you've heard with a friend, you'll find all of our interviews at vpr.net and follow us on Facebook to get an advance look at what's up next on the show and what's happening behind the scenes. Tomorrow, we'll get an update on accusations that Attorney General Bill Sorrell has run afoul of campaign finance laws, and we'll look ahead to Greenup Day this weekend. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Sam Gail Rosen, and Rick Singeri. We have production assistance from Amanda Shepherd. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.